As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Right now, we get interesting GDP revision perspective from Jay Bryson, who's chief economist at Wells Fargo. Jay, do you get a lot of value out of a second look at GDP and, dare I say, the third look?
There's a little bit of value in the sense of what you get in the second release is the first estimate of gross domestic income. It's the income side of the national accounts. It should, in theory, be the same thing as GDP. I'm not sure what that came out as. So you get some of that. You also get corporate profits, which are also important for the economy. So I look at more of the income side of things in the second look here than I do in terms of the demand components.
Jay, how data dependent can you be if you can't rely on the data?
Well, you're always flying blind in this economy. And I guess what I would say, Lisa, right now is there's a lot of choppiness, there's a lot of noise out there. I mean, I kind of, the big picture here, I think, in terms of the economy is it continues to expand. It seems at a modest pace at this point. The labor market, I think, in general, is holding in there. And I think we know that inflation has come down, but it remains kind of elevated. And so I think that's the real narrative that we have to manage at this point.
Well, the narrative has been all over the place this year, as we all know, as we've all been trying to track. And I'm wondering whether this idea of immaculate disinflation moved to perhaps rapid inflation to suddenly now it'll slowly go away. We don't have to worry about it anymore. Is the market underpricing the risk of having to worry about inflation for a longer period of time, forcing the Fed's hand a little bit more?
I think, Lisa, that there's something to be said for that. I mean, if you look at market pricing, and you folks were talking about it earlier, at the end of the year, there's rate cuts priced in there. I think some way to make sense of that would be, the market isn't really good at making precise estimates of probabilities. One way to look at that is a low probability of a really big move by the end of the year because something has blown up, whether it's the debt ceiling or something else along those lines. But if that doesn't happen, then I think that there's a really good possibility that, or there's a possibility that right. You could get stuck at an inflation rate that's higher than 3%. And I don't think the market is priced for that because I don't think the Fed would be cutting in that situation, nor would they actually probably be on hold. They're probably raising rates even higher.
Jay, the heritage of Wells Fargo economics from John Sylvia to Jay Bryson has just been brilliant on the demographics, movement, the fabric of this nation. Do you believe in a rolling recession? I mean, we're aggregating in even to the silliness of an NBER estimate of this dreaded R word. But should we have a belief in a rolling recession given all of the fractured parts of the American experiment?
Well, yeah, Tom, I think there's, it depends what your definition of rolling recession is. I tend to think of one as hitting different sectors at different times. And so, if you look at housing clearly slumped last year. There's some evidence to suggest that's probably stabilizing. Manufacturing, at best, has kind of topped out. The thing that's holding in there right now is consumer spending. And, if you kind of go forward here, if you do have weakness in housing, if you do have weakness in manufacturing, you could see some job losses there, and then that could then bleed over into consumer spending. And so you could have not all sectors going down at the same time, but you could have this, right. you know, as you talk about this kind of rolling, you know, sort of recession thing going on.
And you mentioned the smartest thing I've heard today was Lisa Bramowitz, our airline analyst on Delta Airlines. I mean, that's the single smartest thing I heard this week. It's completely ginormous, sold out, and that's personal consumption. In one way, that's personal consumption.
It's absolutely personal consumption. It will consume your whole paycheck if you try to travel a lot. I do wonder, Jay, though, just going forward, whether we do see some sort of seismic shift coming down the pike for the U.S., given NVIDIA, given AI, given the tech giants that were left for dead, sort of, and then suddenly reprise their greatness this year. Do you think that this is a lasting trend that has implications for jobs, that has implications for gross domestic product?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way I think about it is AI is a potential productivity game changer. You know, it's another, you know, I don't want to get too dramatic here, but, you know, industrial revolution, you know, maybe it's not industrial revolution, but it's kind of like the when we first went to the networking of computers and the internet back in the late 1990s. I think it's even bigger than that if it as it comes along. You know, the issue, though, obviously, is not only is it a productivity game changer, it has profound social and political implications. And that's going to last for years and years and years.
Dr. Bryson, thank you so much for joining us. Brilliant. Jay Bryson there, Wells Fargo parsing. Yes, claims, some news there. Thank you to our Washington team for that great reporting on Massachusetts claims fraud. This is a joy. Douglas Holtz Eakin out of the Princeton shop has done serious work on the debt and the deficit. I'm not going to demean him by asking him about Oval Office discussions or that, but I'm going to ask him about where we are. Of course, his work with the Congressional Budget Office and president of American Action Forum. Dr. Holtz Eakin, I'm going to cut to the chase. You go where the CBO goes, which is to try to estimate our growth rates of revenues, which I think is called taxes, and spending. Where are those glide paths going to be after this debt crisis?
I think it's important to recognize that regardless of what deal is ultimately struck, it will put the tiniest of dents in our fiscal challenge. The fundamental problem is in the large entitlement spending programs. They're off the table. There's room to raise more revenue. That's off the table. So we're not addressing the real issues that face the federal government, the budget. And honestly, until we get serious about slowing the growth rate of the big entitlement spending programs, the budget will never end up. They'd simply grow much faster than revenue ever plausibly will.
I mean, I look where we are and we need a commission. So we need a commission with people with Z in their names. So I can really see Orzag Holtz Eakin or Holtz Eakin Orzag is an intelligent commission that Americans would know as intelligent people coming to an intelligent solution. And yet we're not talking about that. Why not?
This is politics. That's all there is to it. The issue is not the debt ceiling. The issue is not default. There's unanimity that we have to raise the debt ceiling. There's unanimity that we should not even come close to defaulting. There's a big disagreement about the future of fiscal policy. I think it's healthy that this has been highlighted to the American people. My concern has been that in the 21st century, we've never seen the debt do anything but go up, even relative to the economy. And there's never been the political wherewithal to stabilize it, which is, I think, the necessary condition for the U.S. And we really haven't talked about it. If you think back to the presidents we've had, I worked for George W. Bush. I admire him greatly. But his budget said, let's win the war on global terror. You look at the 8 years of the Obama administration. The only thing that they said about the federal budget that might be a problem is the rich didn't pay their fair share. The Trump administration said nothing for 4 years on debt and deficits, and the Biden administration came in with really enormous plans to just expand spending. And so the American people can be excused for not understanding we have a big problem, and we do. Well, but it's time they were told that, and that, you know, addressing it is the thing that we have to do next.
And Doug, they've perhaps been told that, but as Leslie Vinjamori said of Chatham House earlier in the show, it doesn't mean that they're going to accept that they get less at any given day, that they're going to get fewer benefits. And there does seem to be a shift on both sides of the aisle to adding, whether it's respect to investing in technology, whether it's with respect to investing in infrastructure, or whether it's just the spending that we already have in place. it doesn't seem likely that we're going to see restraint in the near future, regardless of what comes from this budget. What's your view in terms of what it would take to make people truly care about a debt limit that doesn't really seem to matter if they could just kick it up and they can keep borrowing at relatively low rates?
They shouldn't care about the debt limit. I mean, there's no real economic rationale for having a debt limit. We're the major economy on the globe that has one, and it doesn't make any economic sense. They should care about the fact that the spending exceeds the revenues as far as the eye can see, and that leads to real threats. They should care even more about the fact that because the entitlement spending is claiming all the revenue, there isn't money for real investments. We're squeezing out national security, basic research, infrastructure, education, the things our founders saw as the role of government. And that's a serious problem for having a more prosperous future. And they should care a lot about the fact that those big programs are taking all the money and they're not financially sustainable. Social Security is going to go bankrupt in 10 years. Someone who is 55 literally can't plan their retirement because they haven't fixed Social Security. That's just unconscionable. That should wake people up.
What's your sense of the tax revenues? We've been talking about how bumpy and lumpy it's been and that it's been underwhelming. How much is this a lack of investment in the IRS and a lack of tax collection?
We've had a longstanding problem with the IRS. It's beyond merely the technology. It's an organization whose culture has been deeply broken. And so it is time to get the IRS back to its job, which is to collect the taxes and do it effectively. We somewhere along the line decided everything should be a refundable tax credit and turn them into a benefits paying organization. They weren't built to do that, and they struggle with it. And so identifying its mission, getting it staffed up, giving it modern technology are all essential.
Great to catch up, Doug. As always on this, Douglas Holtz-Eakin there of the American Action Forum.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It is wonderful to have Diana Amoa with us here, Chief Investment Officer of Long Bay Strategies, Kirkenswald Capital Partners, this morning. I want to go right to the pro discussion, which is you people say, be an EM, participate in EM. Every textbook, every paper says you have to hedge. To hedge or not to hedge is the core issue with EM. How do you hedge EM right now?
Well, if I'm assuming we're talking about hedging the currency risk here.
I go either way you want, but the answer is in financial media, nobody talks about this reality that you have to hedge EM.
Well, the reality is when you look at performance in emerging markets, it's actually been quite resilient. Two things that have been quite notable in the last few months: realized volatility in emerging market currencies and also in emerging market fixed income has been much lower than in developed markets. Mm-hmm. One can argue part of that is, one, inflation outlook in developed markets is much stickier, whilst in emerging market things appear to have peaked. But there was some support coming through from a weaker dollar in the first half of the year. So that's the reality, that emerging market right now this year, if you'd hedged out your currency exposure, you'd have actually been regretting it, because for the most part, EMFX has done well. Where we are right now, I would say you still want to have EM duration. It's a trade that works in multiple scenarios of the world, irrespective of whether we have a recession in the US, whether the Fed cut rates or not. The outlook for emerging currencies, I think for the next few months, might be less clear cut. But if you have a range-bound dollar, I would suggest actually maybe not hedging that.
Not hedging. Yes.
Let's annoy some people, Diana. It's about 8 o'clock. They've had their coffee. They've woken up. They'll be really engaged now.
Thanks.
When we talk about EM, mm-hmm. are we talking about the US, the UK, Europe? Who are we talking about?
Well, typically people say it's the distress stories that you need to watch about. Where are we talking about default right now, John?
The US.
There you go. But, you know, classic definition would argue, you know, US doesn't qualify for an emerging market. But certainly what we're seeing right now with this default talk and the lack of consensus on how to manage the fiscal situation is raising some red flags and making emerging markets look relatively not too bad.
I have a simple EM test. I've had it for a long, long time. Goes something like this. If things get bad in that country, do you buy or sell the debt? It's as simple as that. Now, typically in developed markets, what you do when things get bad in that country, you buy the debt. Typically in EM, you sell it. What's happening with treasuries right now? Because I'm struggling with it. I know it's all at the front end, the bulk of it, but treasuries are selling off and have been for like the last 10 days. What's going on there?
Well, the thing that's interesting with the US market, you're seeing dislocations, particularly in front-end paper. Things that are going to be impacted by X dates. So around the June paper, we're definitely seeing dislocation in pricing. And that's just a factor of the fact that there's no cross-default clauses in treasuries. So they can technically default on a paper without it affecting the rest of the curve. And so markets are trading it that way. And the assumption is if you do get a technical default, it's going to be a short-lived story and actually might tip the economy into recession. So you're seeing this sort of inversion in the curve where people are buying some safe haven duration just to hedge against this outcome.
So for people who might consider some of the developing world emerging markets, some people on this set who might make that suggestion about the US, others would come out and say, what about NVIDIA? What about the tech giants that have performed really well? And they relate this to the bid for US stocks, the bid for US assets over the past decade as being a huge driver. How do you sort of play that story at a time when emerging markets have gotten bid up so far this year, and all of a sudden people are realizing perhaps there's something left in the US?
Well, if you look at the performance in US equities, I think there's a huge amount of dispersion within that. So it's not a one trade for the whole US equity markets. I think it's specific themes that are more longer term and structural, things like the adaptation of AI, what's that doing to various companies and sectors. I think that's a theme that's here to stay. I wouldn't say that that means you buy the whole equity market, but you definitely look for some of these more resilient stories that are going to play out irrespective of whether we go into a recession, Lisa. And then from an EM perspective, most of these innovations are quite commodity intensive. So that's also another theme, whether you're talking about things like AI, electronic vehicle adaptation, the drive towards more sustainable sorts of manufacturing, that's a commodity theme that's going to be also a longer term story.
How do you understand the valuation at a time when some of these stocks are trading like penny stocks, even though they have nearly a $1 trillion valuation?
It's less about that than more about FOMO, in my view. So markets don't know what to do with equities. We've been talking about recession, going from, you know, recessions to default. People are jumping on the stories that look sustainable. So the valuations right now are, it's hard to say it's based purely on fundamentals and more about investors being underinvested in equity markets and not wanting to miss out on the winners.
If you look at all the cash out there, and I don't mean just, you know, typical investment account cash, but private equity cash, just the ginormous amount of cash that's been raised. Do you just assume it will float to equities or does it just stay like a brick in cash?
No, I don't think we're in that world where equities is the no-brainer play anymore, especially not when you have such interesting yields in fixed income. And I think for investors, that's probably the consideration, where whether you're looking at cash yielding close to 5% or even duration in certain parts of the market. So there is money definitely on the sidelines, but I think the days of just buying equities blindly because you had easy monetary conditions are behind us. And investors will look at a much more balanced portfolio.
Diana, awesome as always, and really good to see you in person. Diana Rameau there of Kirkus World Capital Partners. Joining us now is Larry Adam, the Chief Investment Officer at Raymond James. Larry, let's break this interview up in two. We can talk about the debt ceiling in a moment. I want to talk about this rip-roaring rally in tech so far this year. Is that something you want to fight or participate in?
No, we want to participate in it. I mean, if you look at tech, it continues to reinvent itself over and over. The latest generation is going to be AI. And I think as you look at the visibility of earnings, you continue to see a strong
earnings coming. And I think that that's important because a lot of people continue to say that tech has gotten expensive. But when you start to factor in how much tech has been able to beat their earnings, I don't think it's as expensive as what people think. And I think that trend is going to continue.
Is tech just big tech or is it all tech? Is it basically time to go into some of the beaten up smaller tech stocks that aren't necessarily as profitable?
I prefer bigger tech. I mean, first of all, they're much more diversified than the smaller tech companies. I think that's an important discriminating factor, right? Back 20 years ago, tech was one trick ponies, where they had one product, one piece of software, hardware, software, where they had to fight the upgrade cycle. Now they're much more diversified. They have plenty of seeds planted that can continue to generate their earnings going forward. So I continue to like the big tech names. And by the way, from the index level, as you guys have just stated, that's what drives the index. So I think you have to be there.
Larry, I just because you're down south, I want to go to DeSantis and the conference call with Mr. Musk that ran like a Raymond James Swiss watch that we saw last night. You really emphasize second half of a third year of a presidential administration. Discuss the second half of a third presidential year.
Well, I think it's important because what tends to happen in the markets is that momentum tends to beget momentum. And if you look at the strong start that we've had to this year, the first 100 trading days, which, by the way, today's the 100th trading day of the year, when it's up more than 8%, the rest of the year tends to be strong. If you look at this presidential election cycle that you're referring to, it's from June to the end of this year. Historically, 92% of the time, the market continues to be positive. And that's been consistent through time that this third year of a presidential term is fairly strong.
Does cash at 5%, 4.8%, whatever, is that competition for your bullish view?
I mean, it's clearly become more competition today, right? I think at the beginning of this year, we were much more positive on the equity markets with upside of 15%. But clearly, we've had a rally. And our upside to our target now is around 6%. So clearly it's become more competition, but I still like the equity markets longer term for people that have a long-term horizon.
Tom went to the politics, so let's finish there. Larry, the debt ceiling debate of the moment, what are you advocating that clients should do?
I still think that this what's going on down in Washington is still pretty much noise. Right. I mean, I think putting the U.S. on watch by Fitch is just another warning sign across the bow. I think in the end, we get a deal at the very last second. If we don't, I think the downside in the market is probably 5 to 7%. But then, as I always say, the fourth arm of the government, the stock market, will come to the rescue. We see we see that downward movement in the equity market. That'll bring people back to the negotiating table. And we'll get a deal done and we'll move forward.
Is there a signal here that you're seeing dollar strength despite the concern of a U.S. default? Does this basically fly in the face of people who were questioning the preeminence of the dollar as the global currency and prompt you to actually go more into the dollar?
Look, I still think the dollar will continue to be the dominant currency. I really don't see any other currency out there that can really challenge it. This is not a new story. People have been talking about the dollar being challenged with the yen back in the 80s, the euro in the 1990s and 2000. I don't think there's any question that the dollar will remain the dominant currency going forward. I think the two factors out there right now is that when you focus on the euro land is probably going to continue to raise interest rates. The U.S. is going to continue to have better, more dynamic growth going forward. So we're looking for more of a range bound, particularly versus the euro between 105 and 110. And for the most part, that's where it continues to be.
John, he's way too optimistic for 6:09 a.m. I mean, Larry's way too optimistic.
Larry Adam of Raymond James. Thank you, sir.
That was great.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express.
4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
We talk, we speak, we're amateurs. He's not. Mandeep Singh joins us now, senior technology and video analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, for a really important conversation. I got a bunch of questions, Mandeep, but let me just simply start with the addressable market out there over the next decade. There's been some pretty good work on this. Is it like the cloud, where it seems never ending for NVIDIA excellence?
I think so. And what they have done really well is they have gone beyond this narrative of, you know, NVIDIA being just a chip company. And they have actually proved it in the way they have gone about their product launches. So now they have been partnering with the hyperscalers, especially Microsoft. And it's an application that sits on top of Microsoft Cloud, which is how you consume generative AI. And I would say the addressable market for that is north of $1 trillion, simply because when you look at how these services are deployed, the underlying infrastructure, that will become a much bigger portion of overall IT spending. So whether the hyperscalers let NVIDIA kind of continue with that, I am doubtful. I don't think AWS is on board with that strategy, or Google is, but Microsoft definitely is, and that is what is working for them in terms of that cloud play.
Mandeep, what was amazing about yesterday in the guidance was the timeline. It was the fact that this demand seemed to have already appeared in their outlook, in their near-term outlook for the current quarter and beyond. Mandeep, have you got a sense for where this has come from, how they're able to monetize it right now?
Yeah, and I think what is very clear right now is Intel has given up its leadership when it comes to being the primary chip at the data center level. So CPUs used to be, you know, the main chip that you would need to run a server. Guess what? Going forward, you're going to need a lot more of NVIDIA GPUs. And NVIDIA has bundled their networking, GPUs, switches, all in one package, which is the beauty of how you consume things on cloud. So clearly, that shift from CPUs to GPUs is very visible right now in terms of the trend, and that is sustainable. That is not going away anytime soon.
But to build on what John was talking about, the company's forecast for sales during the forward-looking period was 53% higher than analyst estimates. Where did the surprise come from?
Well, so that is a real surprise in terms of what they saw 90 days back versus last night. And clearly, I think the generative AI wave is catching up. Everyone right now wants to invest in this. So the other aspect of it is the supply side. Last year, we were in a supply crunch situation where NVIDIA was one of the vendors that was going to TSMC. Now that supply has normalized, they can make a lot more of these, and they can satisfy that insatiable demand on the data center side. So I do think the supply easing, supply chain easing is helping them, and it's visible in their gross margin. The gross margin is close to 70% for next quarter. That's like a software-like margin, and you're seeing that gross margin expansion on the back of very high demand, which is a very good sign when it comes to fundamentals.
I hate being negative, Nelly, but I do wonder where China plays into this, especially as there are certain bans being placed, or at least restraints, on what U.S. or non-Chinese companies can sell to China with respect to highly capable chip technology. So at what point does that become a headwind or sort of an unknown that challenges some of the absolute runaway valuations of NVIDIA?
Yeah, so you bring up a great point. It happened to Micron this week. And right now, there are export controls around NVIDIA chips. And to my mind, they are actually still under shipping demand on the data center side. So the demand is actually higher, which is somewhat reflected in the guide now. But still, I think if the China market is huge for them, and if, you know, the export controls were to increase, that would certainly hurt them, but I don't think NVIDIA is the only company that gets hurt in that scenario.
Mandeep, they're out 12 months at a 50 times earning. It's really not all that big of a peopled company, 70,000, whatever the employment is. Maybe they're not a takeout candidate, but why doesn't big money come in and take out 10 or 15% of this? Is a stub out 5 years or 10 years? It just makes, to me, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, well, I think part of it has to do with just how the market is positioned right now. There are certain pockets that are in high demand because of the AI wave. And then there are certain segments in on the semi side, which are in a mode where they are inventory clearing and that sort of thing. So clearly, you will see a rebound across different chip segments at different times. And right now, it's anything to do with generative AI that is doing well. And there's a good reason for that, I think, in terms of a transformative aspect.
Mandeep, can we just finish on where Tom started, basically, essentially? How do you value some of these companies at the moment?
Look, I think for a stock like NVIDIA, a lot is priced in. It was priced for perfection last night, too. But then when you deliver this kind of beat, it's hard to be negative simply because, you know, there's, as I said, there's still undershipping demand on the data center side. And the data center business will double in the next 2 years. So it will grow into its valuation. But any slight miss, and we have seen that only with semi companies, they can have a big beat like this, a monster beat, or they can miss big as well. And I don't think it's going to happen to NVIDIA in the next couple of quarters, but that is always a risk. If the hyperscalers were to develop their own chips, their customer base is concentrated. I mean, it's three customers that's buying 50% of their chips, you know, the hyperscale cloud customers. So if they decide to make their own chips or even, you know, anything along those lines, that will hurt the stock.
Just amazing. Absolutely amazing. Mandeep, thank you. Mandeep Singh there of Bloomberg Intelligence on the back of the success of NVIDIA.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keen, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.